Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble, sitting in for Ann today. They grow up so fast. It's a phrase often said by parents lamenting how quickly their children grow up, and still, parents are teaching their children more than ever before and sooner than ever before. Often this comes from a desire to help their child get ahead in a competitive world, but are parents and educators responsible for children losing out on the joy of childhood and growing up too fast? Joining us by phone is early childhood education expert and author of the new book, and she's a New York Times bestselling author of the new book, The Importance of Being Little, Erica Christakis. Thanks so much for being here, Erica.
Thank you for having me.
So as a former preschool teacher and director, what lessons have you learned from your own experience about early childhood education?
Well, as an educator, and I would also say as a parent, one of the things that I've learned, and it's being backed up by a huge wealth of exciting new studies as well as some old evidence, is that kids are working harder these days and actually learning less. And one of the things that I think we need to really push against is what I call a kind of false dichotomy, where we imagine that there's a sort of play-based, joyful childhood on the one hand, and then this kind of rigorous academic learning-based program on the other. And in fact, what we're seeing more and more, and the studies are confirming this, is that there really shouldn't be a trade-off. You know, that children learn through play, they learn through relationships, and we're starting to see more and more evidence that if we want the long-term academic outcomes, as well as long-term positive life outcomes, we actually are really imperiling our children by foisting earlier and earlier sort of reading readiness and some of these pre-academic skills at such an early age. We have what I call the preschool paradox going on right now, where we have on the one hand kids hardwired to learn in so many settings, they're so intelligent and powerful and capable, and on the other hand we have an epidemic, believe it or not, of preschool expulsions. We have more and more kids being medicated off-label for attention problems at very early ages. We have frustrated parents, even frustrated teachers who know that something's off. And the good news is that we don't have to make a trade-off between sort of joy and learning. You know, there isn't a trade-off. But what we do need to do is return to what I would call a child-sized view of early education. We need to really, you know, focus on the young child and how that child learns.
Your book is called The Importance of Being Little. What is so important, Erica, about a child's early years, and is this being threatened by the current educational model?
Well, what's so important about early childhood is that kids are truly, you know, notwithstanding the cliche, they are sponges. You know, they are able to learn in any setting. They are powerful thinkers. They also are, you know, so much products of their social world. You know, they learn just as mammals do, whether it's chimpanzees or dolphins. Young children really learn through social engagement with others, with caring, loving people, with their peers. So I think, you know, what we're doing wrong in preschool is that we're sort of missing the forest for the trees. So if you walk into a preschool classroom nowadays, in contrast to what you would have seen 20 years ago, you're going to walk into a classroom, and if you see it from the adult eyes, it looks like a very pro-learning environment. You know, you'll see all kinds of stuff on the walls, posters and charts and words and these things called word walls, you know, with lots of vocabulary lists, and you'll see calendars and all kinds of sort of clutter that we think of as adults as sort of a pro-learning environment. And when you dig beneath the surface, we're seeing more and more very scripted, kind of rote instruction, a lot more worksheets. We see kids doing what's now become known as seat work, which probably doesn't need any explanation. I don't know, you know, some people may have seen something that to me struck me as parody, but it turns out to be true, that kindergartners in some schools are now working at those treadmill desks, you know, where they have pedals.
Right.
You know, and it seems like a joke, but it's not. So we're kind of imposing a very adult-looking environment on kids. And we congratulate ourselves and say, oh, this is great. You know, we're hitting all these standards, and we are going through our checklist, and they've got these early reading skills, and, you know, they know their alphabet. And what I want to really focus on is that these are sometimes very shallow measures of learning. And so we may be going for the quick fix, where we think that we're really giving kids this great, rich environment, but actually we're not. And what we know is, for example, when kids are playing with blocks, you know, which is such an old-fashioned toy, and blocks are great. Kids all over the world play with some form of blocks, you know, whether it's rocks or bricks or, you know, whatever material right. they have. The reason it's so important to cognitive development as well as social development is because blocks can be used in fantasy play. They can be used symbolically to represent things. So, you know, you can build a tower, you can build a castle, you can hold a block in your hand and pretend it's a cell phone. These are very important cognitive skills that kids go through when they're actually at play. So again, just to kind of, I hope I'm not beating a dead horse,
no.
but I really want to kind of dispense with this fiction that we have a trade-off between play on the one hand and work or learning on the other, because, you know, we really have a lot of evidence that, for example, kids playing with blocks use higher-level language structures than they do when they're sitting at a table, maybe chit-chatting with their peers while they're doing a worksheet. You know, we all have seen those worksheets with the little, you know, grocery carts on one side and then, you know, the number of pennies on the other or whatever, and you have to draw a line between the number and the picture. And, you know, this is actually a very kind of insipid and, quite honestly, you know, not a very deep, not a very cognitively rich approach when you're 4 years old, when most kids that age are having, you know, very complex conversations, sort of existential conversations.
Right.
You know, the things I hear when I go into preschool classrooms are astounding. You know, the things that kids talk about, you know, they're interested in death, they're interested in friendship, they're interested in understanding each other. They are very spiritual, actually. You know, they often sound like little philosophers and scientists and diplomats. You know, they're very good at problem solving. So, you know, the point here is that we have eroded the real kind of natural learning habitat, you know, which is play, it's relationships, it's things like playing, you know, for a long extended period of time outdoors, messing around in the mud, building with blocks. And those, the studies show, those are the areas, those are the environments where kids are using greater, you know, more sophisticated grammatical constructions. They're using, they're understanding cause and effect. They're showing evidence of more complex vocabulary. If you look at mathematical reasoning, for example, you know, with, again, to keep going back to blocks, but it's such a perfect example, you know, kids are doing measurement, they're doing geometry, they're doing physics. The thing is that to adult eyes, it may not appear to be as cognitively important. You know, so I think as adults, we need to sort of resize the early childhood environment and really start looking at it through the eyes of kids. And I often tell teachers when I work with them and parents, I say, okay, walk into the classroom, get down on, you know, kid level, sit down or get on your knees and look around the room. And what do you see? You know, pretend you're a child. And when they do that, it's really a revelation because they realize that so much of the stuff that passes for education is actually very anti-intellectual, quite honestly.
Well, I definitely want to get touch on all of this a little more in depth. You mentioned in your book a little bit about, learning heavy preschool. What exactly is learning heavy preschool?
Well, I think it's, you know, as I said, it's a sort of it's a notion that learning is something that's delivered by the teacher. So there's something, there's a concept called direct instruction, which is where the teacher is very carefully managing the script of, you know, the content of what's being delivered and the topics. In some direct instruction classrooms, they call it DI, in preschools, the content is so carefully delivered that, you know, the teacher is stage managing the kinds of questions that they ask after reading a story. It's very, very scripted. I mean, it's literally following a script. And you see sometimes kids, you know, nodding their head kind of in a very robotic way, you know, answering in sing-song to, you know, as a group in unison to questions. It has a very, it can have a very kind of creepy feel to it. It doesn't look like what most of us remember about our early years as parents. So this direct instruction approach can be effective in the older years, and in limited doses, it can be effective. You know, sometimes you have to deliver a lesson in how to hand wash, you know, wash your hands,
right,
or how to, you know. So I'm not saying that there's no role for direct instruction, but it has proliferated in preschool classrooms to a shocking degree. And the other thing that we have to worry about is that it's kids who are economically disadvantaged, who have fewer of the advantages that would sort of, you know, they may have a parent, only one parent at home, or they may have two parents who are working two jobs and don't have a lot of time to foster a play-rich kind of environment at home. Those kids at economic disadvantage are twice as likely to be in these preschool classrooms that we consider, that experts consider developmentally inappropriate. So those kids at a disadvantage actually have a double burden, you know, because they come into preschool behind in the sense of being, I don't mean behind, you know, in the kind of not knowing their letters, but I mean literally behind in terms of not having had those close relationships or those play experiences. And then in the classroom, they're in these really robotic, routinized, rote, kind of scripted environments. And so we have a problem. And some experts have said that right now with our current preschool system, we can only close the achievement gap between advantaged and disadvantaged kids by about 5%. It has been estimated that if we implemented the kinds of practices I'm talking about with an emphasis on play and on relationships, we might be able to close that achievement gap between advantaged and disadvantaged kids by 30 to 50%.
When did this trend start to change, the learning-heavy school environment for preschool? What is behind it? Is it because both parents are working now? Has that kind of helped, you know, shape how kids are educated and going toward the more testing parents, putting more pressure on, you know, we've got to start early, but, you know, we've also got to get our kids in some kind of affordable care. So what is behind the trend? When did this start, Erica?
Yeah. There are a bunch of factors, and I just want to say that when we, you know, we want to be careful that we're talking about kind of an academic focus. I would argue, and you know, that it's not necessarily a pro-learning focus, but it's certainly an academic focus. You know, it's there are a lot of different forces. No Child Left Behind, I think, really shifted the game back in the early 2000s, and that came from a genuine interest in closing those achievement gaps that I was talking about. Unfortunately, it has not actually had the intended effect, but it was certainly coming from a place of wanting to, you know, help kids at greater disadvantage. The other thing is, you know, as you alluded to, I mean, right now, almost 75% of four-year-olds are in some kind of non-family care. And, you know, that's just the reality. I mean, I've been a working parent. Many people, most Americans are working parents.
Right.
And so, you know, there's no judgment whatsoever here. But nonetheless, we have a pretty unprecedented phenomenon where we have parents really struggling to afford care, you know, and they need child care. And parents' concerns are typically focused on affordability and access. You know, can I actually find a program that will keep my kids safe? And then the sort of deeper quality issues, you know, often are very hard to prioritize, you know, if you're just literally trying to afford a decent place, or you just need a convenient place, you know, which is a very legitimate goal. So I think, you know, we've got a huge, you know, we have a huge shift in terms of a generation of kids who are growing up in non-family care, and we have an opportunity to get it right. But I think what we're doing right now is we are sort of not really focusing on the, you know, we're focusing on adult priorities, and we're not really looking at the child and seeing how he or she learns. And, you know, the other thing is I think parents are very nervous. You know, we live in this competitive world. We've seen, you know, a major recession that had catastrophic effects on many families. You know, these things are in the background as you're thinking about how do you prepare your child for an uncertain future. I have great empathy for that. But we just have to really focus on the research base, you know, which shows that by adopting this kind of scripted, routinized, you know, worksheets and sitting at a desk and parroting back things, that's not the foundation kids need. They need, the studies show that they need a very deep and rich background in oral language, and that comes, you know, when you're 3 and 4 and 5, that comes from play. you know, we know what we need to do, but it's hard to implement. And there are a bunch of reasons why it's hard to implement.
Well, let's get into this a little bit further. But first, we need to take a quick break. We're talking about rethinking the approaches to preschool and early childhood education with author Erica Christakis. Stay tuned. All Things Considered will... All Sides with Ann Fisher will continue in just a moment. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble, sitting in for Ann today. Walk into a preschool classroom in America today and you'll see the walls decked out in calendars, charts, and maps. It's all part of the plan to get early learners ready for their next phase in schooling, but is all that preschool prep really helping kids succeed? This hour we're talking about early childhood education and how children learn best. Still with us is author of the new book, The Importance of Being Little, Erica Christakis. Thanks so much for being here this morning.
Thank you very much.
So in your book, you talk about adultification of kids and what the way they're expected to behave in school. And you touched on that just a little bit before we went to break. Can you explain what that means, adultification of kids in early education?
Sure. Well, I think what we see in early childhood classrooms is that the child is missing in a way. And I call it the Goldilocks problem. You know, I think sometimes, or actually a lot of the time, preschool education is really mismatched to a child's abilities. So often the stuff that we do with young kids is boring and insulting to their intelligence. I'll give you an example. We do a lot of cutesy crafts where the teacher cuts out a lot of the shapes and then just brings the kid over to kind of use a glue stick for 10 seconds and, you know, stick a, whether it's the hand tracing of the Thanksgiving turkey that we're all familiar with,
right,
or you know, the Halloween pumpkin where the teacher cuts out the little triangles. You know, this is actually, if you really think about it, it's not a terribly meaningful or interesting kind of curriculum for kids. So we often dumb down kids' intelligence. At the same time, again, it's this Goldilocks problem. We overtax kids. We have very rapid transitions that children need to go through. We sort of herd them from one task to another. When you're in climates like in the Midwest or where I live in New England, you know, the winter time, it takes a very long time to get winter clothes on kids, and they don't have a lot of time to be outside. You know, the transitions are rapid. We are often quite unsympathetic to some of their emotional struggles. You know, we sort of put a lid on a lot of behaviors that we don't want to deal with. And so the point in this notion of what I call adultification is that we see kids through the eyes, through adult eyes, and we make this mistake again and again. And when we do that, we miss what educators call the peak learning zone, mm-hmm. you know, where kids can learn optimally. And that zone is a very important place to be because you don't want to aim as a teacher or as a parent, you don't want to aim so high that kids can't do things on their own, can't learn on their own, but you don't want to aim so low that you're sort of turning kids off. And so we have to really sort of resize the early childhood, you know, environment to be more child-focused. And when we do that, when we start observing how kids act, then we are more developmentally appropriate. You know, here's an example. A lot of times we assume that four-year-olds have really short attention spans. You know, people joke about this all the time, and they design the preschool classroom with this assumption that kids can't really focus and attend to things. But part of the reason they can't do that is because a lot of the things we ask them to focus on are really kind of silly and uninteresting, you know, like the Thanksgiving turkey exercise. I have yet to meet a kid who really, really enjoyed doing something like that. Now, I've seen children that age attend, you know, for an hour or more at something like, I just last week saw a little kid looking at a pile of sand under a microscope. And then this child was trying to draw a picture of the incredible colors that were in this in these grains of sand, which, of course, she wasn't able to see when she just held the sand in her hand.
Right.
And so this was an amazing cognitive exercise, and she was sticking with it for a really, really long time. You know, and I see kids who hold a newborn baby with real care and delicacy, or they care for a pet, you know, with a lot of tenderness. And yet we tend to think of these kids as out of control and unable to, you know, keep their hands to themselves. And so we do a lot of, I think, kind of insulting curriculum because of these adult expectations and sort of misunderstandings of what it's like to be a young child.
It sounds to me, I get a theme in your book. It talks about the unstructured talking and listening, letting kids kind of learn on their own, like looking at that sand. And it sounds kind of like the Socratic method. Are you a proponent of that? And how much do you think that talking and listening between teacher and student needs to play a role, in current educational courses?
Well, I think
especially in early childhood.
Yes, I think talking is gold. I mean, I say this again and again, and it's really true. Talking and listening—that's the fuel for learning. And Socrates understood this, and I think it's really true at the early childhood level in particular. Now, it's really important that let me just back up. There are studies confirming this. You know, there are studies showing that kindergarten classrooms where teachers use informal language with kids. So that's a fancy way of saying just conversing with them, chatting with them, in sort of informal, less structured ways. Those kids have actually better academic outcomes in fourth grade than kids who had more formal language interactions with teachers. A lot of the talk that teachers use in preschool classrooms is one directional. So it's, okay, kids, time to clean up, you know, or they say crisscross applesauce, you know, these little cutesy phrases to get kids to sit and behave. That's not really the language that's going to create good thinkers and good learners. But when you have real conversation that's going both ways, that is actually linked to these cognitive, you know, these sophisticated cognitive processes. Now, here's the thing, though. I mean, I've been a preschool teacher. I've been a preschool director. I'm a parent of three kids myself, grown up now. You know, it's not so easy when you have 20 kids in a classroom.
Right.
You can't have a free-for-all. And that's where I think we need to understand how hard it is to provide the kind of learning environment we're talking about. You know, in some ways, it's a very natural environment. And, you know, if we kind of let kids just run wild, you know, in the woods, they might be able to figure it out themselves. But actually, back to reality, where we have childcare centers and we want kids to be safe and we have expectations for them, you have to be a sophisticated teacher in order to create a classroom where you've got some routines, you have some behavioral expectations, but you're still allowing, you know, you're still creating a place where a kid can find a handful of sand and stick it under the microscope, or, you know, go to a pile of recyclable materials and say, you know, I'm going to try to make a submarine. That is a flexible kind of teaching where kids have choices and they have the ability to kind of find materials and to explore them. It's not easy to do both, you know, to have the structure. And a lot of times people think that I'm proposing this kind of crazy free-for-all, and I'm not, you know, because if you get back to that learning zone issue, when kids are completely at loose ends, they're not in their peak learning zone. You know, so we have to pay attention to how kids think, how they engage in the world, and kind of craft the environment so we can take advantage of all these wonderful, spontaneous opportunities to grow and to learn.
We're talking about rethinking early education, preschool. If you're an early educator or preschool teacher and you think preschools are doing too much or doing too little, or they're doing things just okay, give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email us allsides@wosu.org. You know, you write, Erica, that kindergarten now serves as a gatekeeper to elementary school instead of a welcome mat, that kindergartners are expected to know how to read before the first grade. Is preschool now the new kindergarten?
Well, a lot of researchers have suggested that it is. I think one kind of telling statistic is that 20 years ago, only about 20% of kindergarten teachers thought that children should know how to read by the end of kindergarten. Now, I think it's gone up to about 80%. So that's, now, whether they really truly believe that or they're just saying, you know, this is what's happened to our system and we require kids to do this. But, You know, that's a really big change. And there's a lot of cultural variation in when kids learn to read. It also depends a lot, quite honestly, on the language children are learning to read. If you're fortunate enough to be an Italian child, it's actually much easier to learn to read because it's a entirely, almost entirely phonetic language. You know, the sound-letter connection is really a simple one. You know, so there's a huge amount of variation. There's no kind of magic moment when kids need to learn how to read. So we're seeing this big shift in our culture where we're pushing down more and more of these expectations. I think it comes at a cost, and we're seeing that the cost is that kids may be learning some of these rote kind of, you know, they're hitting these objectives that are shallow signs of learning, but are we actually giving them the tools to think in a complex way? That comes from hands-on experience. And if we cut short that, you know, we may be doing this kind of short-term wise, but long-term foolish strategy. So yeah, kindergarten is definitely the new first grade. And you know, the other thing is that's not even really a fair comparison because first grade used to be a lot more playful too.
Right.
We have a real problem. One of my colleagues at Yale, Walter Gilliam, has studied this extensively. We have preschool expulsions. It's a growing phenomenon. And usually it's in these classrooms that I was describing where there's way too much emphasis on the kind of direct instruction, you know, very teacher-controlled, scripted environments. And kids really don't thrive in those. I think a lot of people saw the terrible story of the first grader in, I think it was in New York, in a school being berated by her teacher. And, you know, this video went viral of the teacher ripping up the piece of paper and sending the child to a corner. And, you know, it really had a very abusive feeling to it. But I think what we also need to know is not only was that emotionally completely inappropriate, but actually academically and cognitively it was inappropriate too. You know, it's not really helping that child to learn. So, well, yeah, we are really we're doing some really inappropriate things that we need to fix.
I wonder, you know, you touched on a lot there, and when you talked about curriculum for preschoolers, rather than that intense curriculum and workload, how do you envision a free expression preschool mixed in with learning? What do you believe would really help prepare young kids for kindergarten and elementary school? What does that look like?
Well, the number one thing is that children need a very strong foundation in oral language, and that only comes from talking and listening. You know, it just doesn't come from worksheets. And we have evidence of this. You know, their study just came out from Tennessee looking at their preschool program, which had a lot of focus on this kind of scripted, worksheet-oriented. There wasn't great quality control in the Tennessee program. And what was interesting was that in the short term, kids seemed to do better having attended these programs. But then by second, third, fourth grade, they were doing much worse. And the hypothesis is that kids were getting really turned off to learning. Mm-hmm. And as I said, you know, they're kind of parroting. It's actually really not that hard to teach kids to recognize their letters. You know, parents always, and I know when I was a parent of young kids, you know, we get very excited when our kids know their alphabet. It's actually a pretty low bar. You know, it's not really that great a skill. I mean, it's a necessary skill, but it doesn't really get you very far. And so these kids coming from the lower quality programs, my guess is, I don't think we know enough about the studies yet, but my guess is that those kids were not getting that really strong foundation in oral language, which comes from talking. It comes from friendships. It comes from, you know, long extended periods of time to play. So that's at the absolute top of my list for preschool quality. You know, we know a couple of things about good quality preschool. We have one set of variables that people always think are important, and those are called structural variables. So it's things like, you know, the teacher-child ratio or the number of kids in the class or does the teacher have a bachelor's degree in education. Those kind of structural variables, believe it or not, actually have a limited effect on quality. The features that really make a difference for quality are teacher salary, and then does the teacher understand child development, and does the teacher use a warm, responsive teaching style, which you can actually measure? I mean, that's not just a sort of subjective thing. I mean, there are a lot of good scales that can help us measure that. So you know, we tend to focus, when we think about what is a good quality program, we tend to focus on these kind of more structural variables. But really, it's about relationships. You know, does the teacher know the child? Knowing the child in two ways. You know, the teacher needs to understand child development. So, you know, what does a four-year-old typically do? That's really important, because then that teacher in a good program can take that developmental knowledge and put it into curriculum. And then that's where you kind of resist some of the, you know, okay, we're doing this cutesy craft that the teacher designed and the teacher did the cutting. You know, is that really developmentally appropriate? What's the learning goal here? You know, so that knowledge is really important of, like, what does a four-year-old look like? But then the teacher also has to have this warm, responsive, interactive style. And that's the conversation. You know, that's the talking, that's the listening, the flexibility to let kids drive some of their learning.
What about, you know, the studies that suggest children who attend pre-kindergarten have bigger vocabularies and increased math skills? They know more letters, more sounds. Do you dispute that for many, that, that preschool really is a good thing? And is it better to have some than, you know, that might not be in the best structure that with free expression than none at all?
You know, the evidence is pretty clear that high-quality preschool can be helpful to everybody. And when I say high quality, I'm talking about, you know, these features that I've mentioned, the strongly play-based, relationship-based, lots of talking, lots of hands-on experimentation. That's a really great thing for everybody. Now, every kid does not need that, because, you know, kids can get that at home. They can get it in lots of different ways. But high-quality preschool can be very effective. However, the sad reality is that low-quality preschool is not helpful to children. Now, there are some exceptions where a kid literally may have absolutely no other option. You know, if they're truly unsafe at home, if you could do some kind of, you know, imaginary experiment where you said, okay, either I put this kid in a terrible preschool program or, you know, an even worse situation. Yes, those situations, they're very limited, though. But low-quality preschool does not have, does not produce the outcomes that we think it does. And here's the other discouraging thing. Medium-quality preschool doesn't either. But parents need child care. So I think one thing I want to reassure people of, even if they cannot afford the kind of program that they want, the great thing about young children is that they're very adaptable, and when their relationships are secure, when they have a secure attachment to their family, you know, it actually doesn't need to make a big difference if they're spending a few hours a day, or even quite a few hours a day, in a not perfect environment. It's not ideal, but it doesn't have to be a deal breaker for kids if, and this is the big if they have the opportunity at home in their off hours to play, to engage in conversation, to explore, you know. But if they're sitting in front of a screen at home or they're being drilled on worksheets, then I would really worry, you know. And one thing that concerns me is that a lot of parents who are in these really kind of academic, quote-unquote, programs, they're getting the message that their kids are not keeping up, and so then they're doing more drilling at home. And this is just, you know, really the opposite of what we need to do.
Well, we're talking about rethinking approaches to preschool and early childhood education with author Erica Christakis, The Importance of Being Little. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues here in just a moment. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble, sitting in for Ann today. Nationwide, more than two-thirds of children attend a preschool center in the year prior to kindergarten, typically at age four. On any given day, more than 5 million American youngsters attend some pre-K program, but many critics believe that today's current early education system is pushing learning too far. Today, we're looking at what kind of learning environments help children thrive during their preschool and early developmental years. Still with us is author of the new book, The Importance of Being Little, Erica Christakis. Thanks for staying with us.
Thank you very much.
So we left off a little with talking about pre-K and kids, you know, either getting really high quality pre-K or none at all. But I want to talk about families who, you know, lower income families, those who are economically disadvantaged. What is a parent supposed to do, especially when Head Start, for instance, is tied to child care, not just learning, and that's their only option? What do parents do? What do you suggest?
Well, I suggest a couple of things. I think the really good news is that children can learn in so many different environments, and when the relationship between the parent and the child is strong, or between the caregiver, you know, so much learning can happen in any setting, including at home. And I think that parents have been really sort of frightened into almost, you know, letting go of that basic knowledge that the best fuel source for learning is usually between the parent and the child. I think that parents can do a couple of things if they're in a situation that doesn't seem like it's optimal. First of all, you can always try to strengthen the relationship between the teacher and the child, because that's one of the best ways. You know, even if you're in a classroom where the kid is doing, where the class is doing, you know, some activities that maybe don't seem as developmentally appropriate as you would like to see. Maybe there isn't as much playtime. Maybe there's too much of this, you know, worksheet, seat work stuff. If the child and the teacher are close, if they like each other, that is really protective against some of the things that I'm describing that can be very problematic. And parents, you know, can have some role in sort of making sure that the teacher really understands the child, and also helping the teacher to feel validated too. You know, we can really focus on relationships. I think at home, parents can really resist that temptation to drill their kids and sort of, you know, harangue them and hound them, and instead opt for very open-ended conversation. You know, one of the things that I always recommend is, as parents, we have a tendency, you know, if a child is drawing a picture of something, we go up and we label it. We say, oh, that's a nice house. You know, well, sometimes the child isn't necessarily drawing a house, or maybe they don't know what they're drawing. And so even little changes, like if you ask your child, tell me about your drawing. You know, that's an open-ended way of talking with your child that invites your child to kind of take the conversation in a new way. It invites more learning. So I think we can make little shifts at home. Some of them are quite subtle, you know, giving kids more chance to play with sort of open-ended materials like blocks versus, you know, toys that only have one use. So there are lots of things you can do to compensate at home. And my recommendation is that people not, you know, get into this mindset that their kid is falling behind, and so then they have to do all the drilling, and, you know, absolutely not. Do the opposite. You know, find ways to just have a natural, you know, loving conversation with your child. That's something that you can do. And I also think parents need to get more active. They really do. They need to push back. There's so much evidence that what we're doing in preschools is misguided. And teachers are embattled as well. They're frustrated by so many of the standards that they have. You know, they spend a lot of their day filling out forms. And people need to push back. You know, they really do. They need to demand in a polite way. They need to understand, well, what's driving this? You know, why isn't there more recess? Why isn't there more outdoor time? Why are these transitions so rapid? Why are we demanding this? And I think parents need to be much more aggressive about really asking for answers, you know, because all you have to do is a Google search and you will see that the evidence is there that we are really not serving kids well. And I think it's time for parents to get active.
You know, one thing that you wrote that stood out to me that educators have been focused on is that school readiness. But you've been talking about some of the unintended consequences, and one of those is that students become burned out, and before they even get to the first grade, you wrote, children who attended preschool initially exhibited more school readiness skills when they entered kindergarten, but by the time they got to first grade, their attitudes had deteriorated about school, and by the time second grade rolled around, they actually performed worse on tests. You know, all of this, you know, teaching to test and getting ahead before they even get there, is that just burning kids out before they even get started?
Well, it's burning them out, but here's the reason. It's because of this mismatch problem of, you know, what I call the Goldilocks problem, where we are not reaching kids in their peak learning zone. So we're overtiring them, we're overtaxing them, but we're also dumbing them down.
And with things that just aren't interesting to them that maybe they already know.
They could already know. Or here's a great example of a mismatch. You know, this is like the classic Goldilocks problem. And I would estimate that 98% of preschools in America do this. They do daily calendar tracking. So the kids sit in a circle and they talk about what day they're on. They look at a calendar on the wall and they pair it back, you know, today is March 15th or whatever. And one study showed that even after a whole year of calendar work, half the kids didn't know what day they were on. You know, it wasn't working. Now, this is a task that by the time you reach kindergarten, if you're starting in daycare, you may have had daily calendar tracking for 3 years. And this is a too hard, too easy task. It's just a mismatch. You know, it's too hard because in some way, 4 and 5 year olds really just aren't getting the days of the week. You know, it's sort of an abstraction. And if you are, you know, you're not in school on the weekend, and so you have to figure out what the Saturdays and Sundays are. And, you know, there's just a lot of abstraction that is weird to a 4 or 5 year old. At the same time, it's actually really, forgive me, it's stupid. You know, it's not, I mean, everybody learns how to track a calendar.
So why are teachers teaching this way? Why is the education curriculum set up that way? Why is it done like this in every school?
Well, we need to ask some tough questions. I think a lot of American preschool education is driven by traditions. I think it has not kept pace with the reality of kids' lives. For example, the fact that a child might actually be in a preschool environment for 3 years before starting kindergarten. I think teachers lack the training. A lot of them know that this isn't sort of optimal learning. The other thing is we have a huge problem of teacher training. You know, they're very poorly paid. Most preschool teachers are poorly supported. They don't have effective professional development. In many states, we have very lax regulation of preschool teachers. Now, some of them are increasingly in publicly funded programs, and they tend to have more experience and better salaries and so on, which are associated with better outcomes. But, you know, there are still a lot of programs that are just stuck in a very dated mindset. And I think I've been a preschool teacher myself, and I've done some of these activities. I've seen the frustration, and I have a lot of empathy. I see teachers saying, you know, we know that kids can do more, but we don't really know how to do it. And it takes training, it takes commitment, and it takes someone at a higher level saying, you know, we need to stop this pedagogy that is both too hard and too easy. You know, we need to look at what the child is capable of. And that takes commitment. It can't just be an individual teacher or an individual parent. But in the meantime, you know, parents can, we can make small changes that will really make a difference, you know, and just really hanging on to that close relationship with your child, building a relationship with the teacher, that can counteract a lot of the problems that I'm describing.
I want to talk a little bit about economically disadvantaged kids because their parents, you know, really want them to have every possible advantage that they can, so they start them early. But if they are, you know, losing interest, how do those kinds of kids ever get ahead? And is that part of that education gap that we see?
Right, it is. And I said earlier in the program that currently we are only able to close what's called the achievement gap between advantaged kids and disadvantaged kids by about 5%, given mm-hmm. our sort of current system. And if we could implement on a much wider scale best practices in early education, some experts believe we could close that achievement gap between 30 and 50%, you know, which is huge. I mean, that's a huge missed opportunity at a policy level to change things. And you know, as I was saying, kids who are economically disadvantaged are more than twice as likely to be in the kind of preschool classroom where the teacher is using the direct instruction method mm-hmm. Excessively, you know, too much teacher talk, too much scripting, too little choice for kids. So we do have a missed opportunity. The good news, though, is that we have some really powerful studies, some of them are very old studies from many, many years ago, showing that really high quality preschool where teachers are building relationships with kids, where kids have a chance to talk, to be heard, to play, to experiment, children from very profound disadvantaged, financially disadvantaged backgrounds can actually do really dramatically better in life. And there's a very famous study, the Perry Preschool Program. That was a very high-quality program. It was not just any old program. You know, it was really committed to play. It was committed to exploration and, as I said, the friendships and the things we know about child development.
Mm-hmm.
Those kids, 40 years later, they have better health outcomes. They have fewer teenage pregnancies. They are not in jail at the same rates. I mean, we're
right.
seeing major results. They have less heart disease. A strong early environment can make a big difference. Absolutely.
One thing that you wrote that was pretty astounding to me is that some teachers have noted today's kids are less inquisitive than previous generations, and that goes completely against what we think of 3 and 4 and 5 years old. That's just in their nature. They're inquisitive little minds. Why do you think that is, and how can parents help their children become more inquisitive and encourage that learning at home without being so rigid mm-hmm. with using those flashcards and vocabulary lists?
So I think what's happened is that the play impulse is hardwired. You know, we know this from animal studies. Kids are born to play. But the play know-how has sort of been eroded, you know, because of all the usual culprits. We have a much more academic focus in preschool. Kids are spending more time in front of screens. They have less outdoor time. They have less freedom. You know, their schedules are more regimented. These are kind of imagination killers, you know, if you think about it. I mean, the imagination flourishes when kids have time to reflect, to imagine, to play. And so we've got, you know, the play impulse is there. But the play know-how, that requires a really big cultural commitment. That's not something that you just, you know, I see kids all the time. The parents tell me, you know, my son doesn't really want to play. And that's very frustrating for parents because they keep thinking, you know, they're thinking, well, you keep telling me how great play is, but, you know, the play I'm seeing looks kind of stupid. And I think that is a real problem. So how do we repair that kind of play habitat? And I think we do it by, we try to look at the world through the child's eyes, not through the adult's eyes. And that means give more stretches of uninterrupted time. You know, if a child appears bored, the temptation is to whisk the activity away and to move them along. Instead, we need to let kids dig in and get unbored. You know, and that comes from, you know, the more you play, the more you learn how to get unbored. Unbored, I mean, you know, like,
right.
Yes, and not bored. But if you don't really have that experience of playing with, let's say, open-ended materials like blocks, you know,
right.
where you, or, you know, sometimes people say that their toddler is more interested in the wrapping paper and the box to a present than the actual present. Well, you know, that's true. But I think that if you're a child who's really used to a lot of screen time, a lot of electronics, a lot of toys that have one particular use, if you suddenly give that child a bunch of blocks, you know, they may balk and say, are you kidding me? You know, what am I supposed to do with this? So we have to kind of retrain kids to develop that play know-how. And that's where the imagination comes from, which is really linked to cognitive outcomes. You know, we need imaginative kids. We need inquiring children. But I think the adults, and I would say parents and teachers and policymakers, you know, we need to kind of look at this play. I call it the play habitat, and we need to recognize that it's been eroded. It's been sort of encroached, and we need to do what we can. One great thing that parents can do is look for mixed age play. You know, that's sort of a casualty of our modern lives, is that kids have fewer chances to be in those mixed age groups.
And they're doing so many scheduled activities as well with people of peers of their own age.
Right. And in some ways, that's a little bit of an artificial sort of ecosystem, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and a lot of parents tell me, you know, I would let my kid play outside, but nobody else is outside. And so we need to try to repair that play habitat, and the adults need to do that. We need to really help kids to develop that play know-how.
Well, it's been a very interesting conversation this hour. Erica Christakis, thanks so much for being here. Her book is The Importance of Being Little.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble, sitting in for Ann today. Thanks so much for listening to 89.7 NPR News.